This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Love now and
did you fall in love last time?
I love
love was stronger than anything.
For the love, love.
And I love you more than anything.
There's to love.
Love.
From the New York Times, I'm Anna Martin. This is Modern Love. In this week's essay, Ari Diaconis writes from a place of deep physical pain. He has a chronic illness, and he's trying to figure out what his future looks like. With the career he's put on hold, the daily chores he can barely manage, and the woman he really loves, but can't show up for anymore. His essay is read by MacLeod Andrews.
The wristwatch collection at the Tourneau showroom on 57th Street fills four stories. I was on the ground floor at the Rolex booth. A salesman fit a black-faced Datejust around my wrist. "The Datejust is the classic Rolex," he said. "The foundation." I had tried on the watch four times. I knew it was a new foundation I wanted. For 2 years, I have been treading water in a sea of obscure neurological illness. It feels like a serious and unrelenting flu, and it keeps me in bed unless I make a major effort to get out. My eyesight is warped and psychedelic. I'm always nauseous, and there's a constant throbbing pressure in my head. No doctor has been able to tell me definitively what it is. I'm 32. Dunya is most of what remains from my old life. In our cozy bed, my disability disappears behind nuzzles and entwined legs. We have a connection strong enough to convince me that there is still a world outside of my discomfort and twisted vision. We met in law school when I was a chiseled rock climber with outstanding career prospects. I watched her sheepishly from my nook in the law school reading room, near the 9-foot-tall grandfather clock, carved with a statue of Lady Justice. We eventually bonded over hamburgers at a campus cafeteria. A week later, I organized a group paintball outing, mostly as an excuse to invite her. Then we got together for a bike ride and brie-stuffed French toast at a local breakfast spot. 6 years later, our refrigerator is decorated with souvenir magnets from our trips across America. She's my girlfriend and partner in life, even in my sickness. I massage her knotted shoulder when it freezes up, and we find pleasure in hashing out legal issues from Dunya's job as a corporate lawyer. When I'm well enough, I go with Dunya to the dozens of weddings she is invited to every year. Apparently, she still relishes having me as her tuxedoed guest. And that makes me happy. "These watches keep time perfectly," the salesman said. I was coming off a month of almost constant bed rest. I was antsy and overcome by a compulsion to do something. Stomp my feet, scream, buy a wristwatch, anything. Maybe a watch would be an important investment, a commitment to my future during this difficult time. "Just do it," I told myself. "Do something." It was an extravagant purchase, worth more than 3 months of rent. I had managed to hold on to the hefty bonus I had earned 3 years earlier before taking medical leave from my Wall Street law firm. "I'll buy it." The salesman, suddenly quite spirited, set into motion a cascade of fanfare. His assistant produced a miniature bottle of champagne from a back room, the mere sight of which triggered my nausea. A young man in a slim suit peeled the protective wrapping from the sapphire crystal of my chronometer and began to polish feverishly. A barrel-chested technician emerged from behind an elevator door and measured my wrist, saying, "Sir, we should remove one link." While the watch was being adjusted, I handed over my debit card and gulped. Part of me felt as if I had purchased a distant star and named it after myself. Chronic illness is a grind. Renowned neurologists have told me I have disorders I never knew existed. Dysautonomia, autonomic failure, persistent visual snow. They've assured me these conditions aren't terminal, but I'm less concerned with death. Rather, I am concerned with how to live. How to maintain health care coverage. How to sustain disability insurance. As my roommate and sometimes caregiver, Dunya has witnessed my struggles, including ambulance rides and crying fits. She stands by me nonetheless. Maybe it's no coincidence that Dunya means the world in Arabic, because having her with me is everything. We would be married if I wasn't sick. I left the vast Tourneau showroom that day, lighter in the wallet but heavier on the wrist. The watch felt dense, luxurious. It delighted me. I shuffled toward the subway and wondered what Dunya would think about the small fortune dangling from my arm. Our bedroom is a cloud of freshly painted white walls, soft sheets, and warm bedside lighting. This is our hideout, a treehouse floating above the pandemonium of New York. "You're still the smartest and most handsome man I know," Dunya says to me in our hideout. "I'm proud of you. Proud of how you're handling this." Then at other times, she's lost to me, behind an invisible wall of uncertainty and fear as we talk about the future. A load of laundry overtires me. I can't imagine the marathon of work, parenthood, and home ownership. Lately, I have thought that the best thing for Dunya would be for me to leave her. It would free her from the burdens of a disabled partner, provide her the opportunity to find someone new and healthy to build her life with. I said nothing of the shimmering fixture on my wrist when she arrived home from work. "Wait," she said, "what's that on your wrist?" "It's so beautiful," she said. "I fully support this. You deserve it." She asked to try it on. I watched Dunya as she studied the Roman numerals on the dial, and I was overcome by the notion that she and I were moving through time together, like musicians playing from the same sheet music. Our future may be unsure, but isn't everything? As the second hand on the date just skated forward on Dunya's wrist, I saw that it meant nothing other than the now. The togetherness of Dunya and me, alive and undeniable, good and right. I can no longer say whether time is kind or just, if I ever could. Dunya and I may adapt fully to this life. Maybe not. It may be true that time heals all wounds. I can't say. Who am I to judge time?
Ari Diaconis died in 2018. He was 33. After Airy died, his essay was published with the help of Dunya and his family, including his little sister, Alex. Airy's younger sister is a lot younger. There are 7 years between him and Alex. Alex's childhood memories of Airy all happen outside, climbing trees, playing frisbee, summers at the swimming hole. Growing up, Airy was kind of Alex's idol. Everything he did, she'd do too. Airy was a drummer, so Alex learned to play drums. Airy got into filmmaking, and Alex studied filmmaking in college. When Airy moved to Brooklyn, Alex moved just 10 minutes away. Alex says when they were growing up, it was instinctual for her to look up to Airy, just like it was instinctual for him to care for her. Alex?
Hi, Anna.
Tell me a little bit more about what Airy was like as an older brother. Was he like a protector? Did he tease you a lot? Was it a mix of both?
No teasing. None. I was way too sensitive for that. He was very, very protective of me. Mm. And in a quiet way, though, he would not ever be overbearing. I remember my dad, myself, as a probably 2-year-old, mm-hmm. and Airy were going on a bike ride. And my dad had me in the little baby backseat carrier on his bike and didn't have a helmet on me. My dad didn't put a helmet on me. And Airy, he was 8 years old, probably maybe 9, he looked up and was like, put a helmet on her. And I actually fell off that bike and cracked the helmet and was fine.
Wait, so your dad did put a helmet on you?
Yes.
After Airy said, as a 9-year-old, put the helmet on my sister?
Oh, yeah.
And then you did fall off the bike, but you were okay.
Yeah. My dad told that in the eulogy at Airy's memorial, and I was like, oh, wow. He actually, like, saved my life, possibly.
Wow. 2 years before Airy died, Airy and Alex went on another bike trip as adults, and not just any bike trip, a 3,000-mile Florida to California bike trip. Airy was sick at the time, but he was determined to push through. And the only person he wanted by his side was a sister. Alex and I are going to talk about that bike trip after the break.
This podcast is supported by Cartier.
Noelle was in London for a couple of weeks and we met on a dating app and we went on a first date on a Wednesday, and by the Thursday we were booking flights to Lisbon together. So it was a very successful first date. We just kept thinking this could be the last time we see each other. So we just made every moment so special. Every coffee, every meal we went on, every dance party we went to, it was like that was all that mattered. That was the moment, and we just felt everything, felt so much love for each other in that moment, and then the rest didn't matter. She's not ever been shy to make me feel loved, and she's never held back on making me feel special. And that to me is so important. From the day I met her, she made me feel like the most special person in the world. And now she's my wife.
With love, from Cartier.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
Alex, I'm really excited to hear about this bike trip you took with your brother, Airy. It sounds incredible. Who had the idea for the bike trip in the first place?
It was 100% Airy's idea. before college, he had gone on a bike trip from New York to Florida. So it seemed like, oh, let's pick up where I left off. Let's go from Florida to California. So I just said yes. And it didn't seem at all crazy, other than that he was sick. At the time, a lot of doctors advised him to exercise to help with his illnesses. So I think this was kind of him being like, let me exercise and also spend time with my sister and go across the country.
So you get on the road, you kick off the trip. Tell me about sort of how the two of you were riding on this road.
Yeah, it looked the same for 3,000 miles, which was us on the road with the same exact bike, but his was bigger. And he was behind me the whole way. When you do long distances, you often draft off of the strongest rider.
What does that mean, draft?
You get as close as you can to the bike in front of you within like a few inches, and it cuts the wind for the rider behind. And so he was drafting off of me. And maybe from an outsider's view, you know, this big, strong man, it would typically be the opposite, but it's because, you know, he was actually weaker. He would tire easily. So he drafted off me the whole time.
How did the route affect Aerie's health?
You know, there was one moment where we're out in the middle of nowhere and it was like an 80-mile day. And I think he literally just screamed in pain and pulled over and just laid down. And his head was just like exploding. And he looked really sick, really, really pale. I think my mind would freeze at those moments. There were some times where I would try and instinctually try and flag someone down. And Aerie would be like, don't, there's no one can do anything. It was a panic, total panic. And we didn't have phone service. No one was around. So I just was dependent on him to hopefully feel a little better and get back on the bike, which he did, you know, pretty shortly after. And it's hard when, yeah, he's the person I would go to for help and support. And when that person is collapsed at your feet, it's really scary.
Tell me about the end of the trip when you arrive at your final destination. How did that feel when you finally got off the bike and the trip was done?
The last day was not a joyous day. It was a relief to get to San Diego, but it was the one day Aerie and I got into an argument on the whole trip. We were frustrated and having trouble, you know, entering the city with directions, and he was frustrated, and it was very unusual, and I was confused. He started pedaling another direction, and I started pedaling another direction. It was very dramatic. And he turned around and gave me a hug and just said, you know, I'm sorry. I thought I'd be feeling better at this point by the end of the trip. And that was heartbreaking to hear. You know, I knew he had hoped it, but he really felt it, and it was hard.
Alex, thank you so much for telling me about this trip and about your brother, Aerie.
Yeah, thank you for listening and caring.
Alex made a beautiful website for Aerie's memorial that has a bunch of photos from their bike trip. If you'd like to see them, she'd love to share in memory of her brother, and you can find the link in our show notes. Modern Love is produced by Christina Josa, Elissa Dudley, Julia Botero, and Hans Buto. It's edited by Sarah Saracen. This episode was mixed by Dan Powell, who also created our wonderful Modern Love theme music. Original music in this episode by Dan Powell and Alicia Beitoup. Digital production by Mahima Chablani and Nell Galogli. A special thanks to Anna Diamond at Autumn and also to Alex Diaconis. The Modern Love column is edited by Daniel Jones. Mia Lee is the editor of Modern Love Projects. I'm Anna Martin. Thanks for listening.